Namaste, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 210th, Francis Goes All the Way. My name's Dick Newman. Let's circle back. Just a little bit of Puccini there to help get your day started. Who cares what happened last week, apart from ending up with Francis Drake? We finished up his backstory, but left him with a burning desire to sail the Pacific Ocean. Okay, there was also a catch-up on Betty, who was calmed down a bit after the Dudley marriage to Lettice Knollys. And we had Alencon, Betty's little frog, singing the Rainbow Connection for us, who strolled in for some wooing. We checked in on Catherine de Medici, with it still going badly in France. We had a look at Walsingham's police state in England, met a couple of pro-torturers and found out that Catholicism is actually on the rise rather than going backwards. Yeah, that happens with bands. But I'm keen to continue on with Francis Drake, which means we need again to go back from our 1580, but just to 1576, and he's got his new flagship, the Pelican, to be renamed the Golden Hind. We'll get to that. Drake will employ 160 men and boys for his fleet. Okay, men and boys, we're just going for a squiz at the Mediterranean, he lyingly said. If he'd told them he was heading for the Straits of Magellan, then they probably would have said no thank you to that job offer. These sailors should have been awake because Drake will be taking a number of gentlemen with him. Not gentlemen. Including an amateur naturalist. Lawrence Elliot, who specialised in botany and will one day provide Europe with descriptions of exotic flora. Yeah, his book will be good. We'll even have a black guy on board. This is that Diego guy who'd helped Drake out in the treasure house stuff when he stole all that Spanish gold. Drake knows this is going to be a long voyage, so he will even hire some musicians for entertainment. Nice sea shanties to keep us all amused. He'll take enough food for 18 months and all sorts of hardware and, of course, weapons. 5 p.m, 15th of November, 1577, and Drake is off on what will be the longest voyage ever undertaken. Bad weather, so it takes shelter in Falmouth, there in Cornwall, then back to Plymouth for repairs. Yeah, that didn't go off too well in the start. Drake will sack his Irish mate, James Siday, who had been responsible for the food supplies. Not good enough, says Drake, and Siday can fuck right off. Now, one of those gentlemen, we've got gentlemen on board, who was also an investor, was saying to a carpenter that sacking Siday was a bad idea. He said that Siday was essential to the voyage, and worse, he, the gentleman, was not consulted about this sacking. So far as he was concerned, he was Drake's equal on this voyage. Oh no, ladies and gentlemen, there is only one captain. Only one. Anything else is a bad, bad idea. He goes on saying he will form a group of 12 super loyal guys, and hang on, it's starting to sound like mutiny. We haven't even fucking left England. Just as well we're still on dry land. But for now, that carpenter will be keeping his gob shut. 13th of December and we can be off again. Sailing south past France and past the northwest of Spain and past Portugal and past Gibraltar and hang on a tick, say the crew. You just sailed right past the Mediterranean, and we're off the coast of Africa. Did you get lost? Nah, says Drake. Not lost, just a change in destination, lads. At this stage, though, there's no reports of general discontent. It must be going well. Here we are at the Cape Verde Islands off Africa. Portuguese territory, but we wouldn't mind some fruit and veg and a bit of meat too. Now, did I mention he's already raided about half a dozen Spanish and Portuguese ships, which may be why the crew are cool. Profit share arrangement would be in place. Oh, look, there's another Spanish ship. Drake will send a ship after her, and there you go. That ship had just taken on supplies. So we'll have all those nice supplies. Thank you. And, oh, look, they've got an astrolabe. And they've got a handy Google Maps thing with directions for how to get to Brazil. And, oh, look, a Portuguese pilot who's got experience in South America and some very nice maps. Now that we look closely, this Spanish ship is way better than our ship that captured us. So, oh, well, we might as well swap ships too. Now off you go there, Spaniards. Now, our gentleman, who thinks he's Drake's equal, will have a wince that Drake's brother, a crewman, had opened a chest of stolen Portuguese stuff to forage for whatever. Francis Drake will be more than a bit annoyed and say, you're just trying to undermine me. There is another story about this, and in this one it was the gentleman who nicked a bit of Portuguese stuff for himself. No, he tells Drake, a Portuguese gentleman just spontaneously gave me some presents. Whatever the case, it'll be smoothed over. For now. Drake will appoint the gentleman to captain the flagship, the Pelican. That won't help. Our gentleman will soon be talking to the crew of the Pelican about how we should ditch the rest and go off on our own. Now, it's hard to think that Drake would not have gotten wind of this. Drake will send a guy on a routine mission to the Pelican, and our gentleman will get into an argument with him. Drake will send another boat with instructions to bring the gentleman in for a chat over tea and scones. And he won't be coming in for a happy chat. He's to be off to the store ship, and a big demotion from captain. 5th of April, 1578, land ho. After 4 months, we're off the coast of Brazil. 2 weeks in a river mouth, killing seals, taking on fresh water and repairing our ships, and waiting for ships that had got separated from the fleet. In comes the store ship, and it's not all happiness there. Trouble with our gentleman again. Same story, telling the guys on that ship that he was the big swinging dick and we all need to listen to him. One of the shipmates will be saying, look, this guy's talking up mutiny. He needs a good hanging. No, 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 says the gentleman. Drake doesn't have the authority levels, and hangings are for dogs, not gentlemen. It's not only this gentleman who's the problem. The other gentleman also thought that work was beneath them. Lazy fuckers. Class systems, my dear listener, do not apply on those type expeditions. It needs to be all hands on deck type of thing. We're getting two factions forming, sailors and gentlemen. One of Drake's senior seamen will refuse to dine with the captain and the gentleman. Oh, sure, fuck off, say the gentleman, and enjoy eating gruel with the peasants. But this particular senior seaman has got clout, and the sailors will now get the good grub, and the gentleman can have the gruel. It will get to an argument with the seaman pointing out that if you don't work on the ship, then don't expect good tucker. This will come to blows, and our original very annoying gentleman will be back to talking up mutiny. Drake will issue a knee to the testicles and have him tied to the mainmast for a day. Fortunately, the crew were rather busy with seal killing and bird killing, so stayed out of it. But we can't be heading into the dangers of the Straits of Magellan with this shit fuckery going on. Drake's also getting friendly with the locals. He'd leave gifts out, and the locals got the idea, taking the stuff and then leaving gifts for the English in return. Before you know it, we're mingling. 3rd of June, and time to get back underway. Our gentleman will refuse to board, and Drake's over it. He will have the gentleman manhandled onto the ship. Out comes another gentleman, and he's packing. That bit of treatment was too much for him. I will yield myself to the cannibal's hands, and so I pray you all to pray for me. Drake will say, don't be a dick. Get on the ship. He will, but it's disobedience, which is not on when you're at sea. Drake had worded up the sailors to steer clear of the gentlemen and give them the silent treatment. We'll keep on going south and get to a natural port just north of the Magellan Strait. And what do we see? A gallows, where Ferdinand Magellan had hanged a guy for mutiny. Drake knew that it was there. He'd read the book, the Magellan book, of course. This thing's been there for 58 years, so it must have been very well made. We're close to the danger zone, so Drake needs to sort out that gentleman, and this might be a good place to do it. In goes Drake in a small boat with some guys, and out come the locals. Should be friendly, and the last lot were. In come some arrows, and down go two sailors. Drake will manage to get a shot off with his arquebus and get a local right in the guts. That'll be it for the locals. They're off like daddy's pants and won't be seen again. The crew will come ashore, set up camp. Then the time has come. Now, Drake has plenty of written testimony about our gentleman and his mutinous comment. Thomas Doughty, you have sought by divers means to discredit me to the great hindrance and overthrow of this voyage. Besides other great matters wherewith I have to charge you withal, the which, if you can clear yourself of, you and I shall be very good friends, where, to the contrary, you have deserved death. Nah, that's bullshit, says the gentleman. How would you like to be tried, asked Drake. In England, mate. No way, says Drake. I will here empanel a jury on you to inquire further of these matters that I have to charge you withal. Now, this gentleman is a lawyer, so he'll ask to see Drake's commission and whether it includes running a trial. No, you're not seeing it, says Drake, and tells his guys to tie this fucker up. Lawyering isn't that much help if you're on a remote island. Drake will accuse the gentleman of having poisoned the Earl of Essex. No way, he says. Listen to the podcast that Dick Newman put Dudley down for that, and, like King Donald, Dick is always right. And besides, it was me who got you that Irish job with the Earl of Essex, Walter Devereux, in case you forgot, my dear listener. Well, that's a known goal. It's a small lie that has nothing to do with the current case, but a lie is a lie, and getting caught in any lie in a trial is a bad, bad, bad thing. Don't do it, my dear listener. If you're ever in a trial, do not lie about anything. The trial will go on, but the big da-da moment will be when our gentleman said Cecil had knowledge of the voyage. What the fuck, dude, says Drake. How the fuck did Cecil know about it? I told him, says the gentleman. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I can now reveal to you that Cecil was absolutely not supposed to know about it. He's way too scared of upsetting the Spaniards right now. Dudley signed off on it, and Walsingham signed off on it, and they got the nod from Betty, but all three had said, oh, look, we can't let Cecil know. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. What this fellow hath done. God will have his treacheries all known, for Her Majesty gave me special commandment that of all men my Lord Treasurer should not know it. But to see his own mouth has betrayed him. Okay, says the gentleman, how about I try this one that has never ever worked ever before? I do not recognise this court and need this thing to be moved to England. Another gentleman, who's also a lawyer, will let Drake know his opinion is that this court is illegal. I have not to do with you, crafty lawyers. Neither care I for the law, but I know what I will do. The jury will retire to consider its verdict. Yeah, guilty. Okay, what's Drake got to say? You may see whether this fellow has sought my discredit or no, and what should hereby be meant but the overthrow of the voyage, as first by taking away of my good name and altogether discrediting me and then my life. And now, my masters, consider what a great voyage we are like to make. The like was never made out of England, for by the same the worst in this fleet shall become a gentleman. And if this voyage go not forward, which I cannot see how possible it should if this man live, what a reproach it will be, not only unto our country, but especially unto us, the very simplest here may consider of. Therefore, my masters, they think that this man worthy to die, let them with me hold up their hands. Yeah, no going on to glory if this bloke doesn't die, is the message. Up go the hands and off goes the head. Historians puzzle over this guy. I know, he was a dick. There's still the division, though, between the gentleman and the sailors. Time for a rousing speech. It will be we're all in this together, and gentlemen need to pull their weight, and sailors need to accept that gentlemen are necessary for the sake of the government. Now, I can spare one ship for anyone who wants to go home without any Spanish treasure at all. And if you take that ship, then you need to be off home, because if I see you hanging around my Spanish treasure ships, then I'll sink you. Sleep on it and let me know. Nobody will want to go home. 20th of August, 1578, and we're at the Cape of Virgins, entrance to the Magellan Strait, and it looks pretty tricky. Drake will have the churchy stuff done, then rename the pelican the Golden Hind. Now, that might be something to do with Betty's other favourite, Sir Christopher Hatton, the pretty boy dancer. Betty Favourite and mate to the guy Drake just executed. Yeah. His family thingy, crest or whatever it is a hind. So Drake might be sucking up a bit there. And we're off once more, this time to go through the tricky straits, stopping at the odd island to knock off some tasty penguins. This is hard going. It's 300 miles long, and while the current is with him, winds just come from all directions. Some parts of the straits are very shallow, other parts too deep to measure. There's lots of islands to get through, but after just 14 days, he's done it, and we're in the Pacific. In Magellan, it took 37 days. Other guys will take up to 4 months. Okay, we're in the Pacific and heading for Peru. The deal, if we all get separated, is that's where we'll meet, 30 degrees south, which is actually chilly, but who knows. At the moment, they're calling it Peru. Drake will head off northwest, and geographers will be saying, what are you doing, mate? Drake will hear you. You should be heading north, not northwest, but his map's dodgy. Drake will end up correcting that map. Storm in from the north, pushing the ships back south. Big storm. Weeks of storm. Big waves. Shit sandwich, no bread. They will find the odd anchorage, only to be swept back out in the storm. One ship will go down with 29 sailors not going home. Drake and his other ship will be separated. Other ship will sneak back into the Magellan Strait for shelter and take a few weeks to recover. After recovering, the story's a little bit vague, but the one we're going with is that the crew will menace the captain into heading for home and safety. As he'll get there first, he will be sure to make the story stick, that one that he got menaced into it by his crew. He never deserted Drake, according to him. Sailors made him do it. And he'll be sure to say the execution of Doughty was all Drake's idea. Some of his crew, though, will say, yeah, look, it was the captain. He chickened out. We were all going on for glory. Still, he has disproved that you can't sail back through the Magellan Strait because of the current. So well done, that captain. Eight of his guys will go off for something or other in a boat and never be seen again. One guy will have a whoopsie on board and die. Two will desert to the Portuguese in Brazil. But June 1579, he's back in Devon saying Drake's somewhere in the Pacific or maybe dead. Who knows? We know. Drake's a mighty hero, and the Golden Hind is one of the best-known ships in history. Of course he's alive. Now, he'd been blown south of the Magellan Strait, which means we've worked out that if you do go south of the Magellan Strait, you sail around the bottom of that American continent. There's a big old bit of ocean between South America and Antarctica. His primitive maps had shown this is all land, terra australis. Australis meaning to the south. Forget the Magellan Strait, we've now got Drake's Passage. Very tough place for ships, though, with waves up to 40 feet high. Not for the faint-hearted. That's because that's where the Pacific and the Atlantic meet, and, yeah, you get these big waves. Drake will do the planting of the flag and claim those southern islands for England, naming them the Elizabeth Islands. Drake has sailed to the most southerly point of America, so he could claim to have sailed further south than any human ever. That storm had lasted 58 days, leaving Drake's ship on its own. It's also laid down some of the crew with scurvy. Two will die, and the rest will recover. Drake can start heading north again, stopping off to kill birds and seals for dinner. 25th of November, and he'll stop off in Chile, meeting some locals who will provide a couple of sheep, some hens, and maize. These guys had met the Spaniards previously and had some success attacking their forts. Part of their success was emulating the foreign invaders. They've nicked some horses and learned to ride. They've lengthened their spears like the Spanish cavalry and created a noose on a pole to catch Spanish horses. Some have even nicked arquebuses and cannons and taught themselves to use them. These guys will continue against the Spanish with a fair degree of success, so well done you guys in Chile. Thanks for that bit of entertainment, locals, but like Drake, I might have got Chile and Peru mixed up. Frank, they may have overestimated their friendliness to these new type Europeans. And he goes on a long boat to get some fresh water. Out come the locals with plenty of arrows. Two English dead, and the rest all scored a wound. Drake got an arrow just below his eye. The ship's crew want to turn the cannon on the locals, but Drake will say, "Don't do that. They just thought we were Spanish." Drake's heading for Spanish ports. Those guys are easier to do over than the locals. Drake will take some Spanish prisoners who, when released, had to write about their experience for the Spanish authorities. From these guys, we get a picture of a well-run ship. Sailors all fully drilled, weapons kept in tip-top condition. Drake was kind to his men and joked around, but was strict on discipline for breaches of his rules. He demanded obedience and respect, but he would get in and haul a rope or dig for water alongside the common types. I endeavoured to find out if the captain was well-beloved, and everyone told me that they adored him. The Spanish prisoners were all worried that they would be killed. That's the standard for the time. But no, Francis Drake will explain, "Look, hey guys, I like the Spanish, just not your stupid government. If you want to resist me, then sure, I will kill you. But none of this executing prisoners." Don't they, my dear listener, think he's some sort of cute, cuddly, mighty hero? If a prisoner withheld valuables or information, then Drake could turn nasty. But by the standards of the day, he is more than reasonable. Vasco da Gama, that Portuguese pioneer, will describe a case where several hundred prisoners, men, women and children, were just put on a captured ship and the ship set afire. The Spanish have massacred the French in Florida and they just hang any English guys they catch. Let's get ourselves to Valparaiso, which is the port for Santiago in Chile. For the December 1578, and Spaniards aboard a ship will see a strange-looking ship heading in. No cause for alarm. The only ships in the Pacific are Spanish. We all know that. Yeah, everybody knows it. The new ship will send the boat over, and the Spanish will even pipe the guys aboard. Up comes one of Drake's big guys and smacks a Spaniard in the face, yelling, "Go down, dog." And that's it. Spanish just give up, with just one guy hopping overboard to go and raise the alarm. Jake will send another two boatloads of guys, capture the town. Great. The ship and the little town can be ransacked. Off we go further north, towing that captured ship behind us. Drake has to keep going to keep that surprise element up. By the same token, he's being slowed down looking out for his two missing ships. Not all champagne and wreaths either. Stopping off for water, he'll be surprised himself by Spanish hard men and lose one of his crew. Off he goes again, getting a bit of plunder here and there, but he's headed for Arica, a small settlement, but the place where the silver is stored, ready to be shipped to the treasure house in Panama. In they go, capturing two small ships, but it's only 37 bars of silver. Worse, the element of surprise is gone. Spaniards have ramped up their hard men guards on the precious stuff. He will set his prisoners free on the stolen ship and head towards Lima. More plundering and good information from a captured captain. "Yeah, there's a couple of ships with plenty of silver just up the road a bit. If you're quick, you should be able to get them." And he goes to find one at night, but its cargo hadn't been loaded yet. This was a port with up to 30 ships. The English will disable a couple that may be a threat and, of course, nick some stuff. While that was going on, another ship sailed in. Out come the port authorities to see what they're about and notice another ship there. It's Drake's ships. "Oi, who are you, mob?" they yell. One of Drake's men could speak Spanish. "Oh, just a merchant in from Chile," he says. In come the authorities and they can see cannon. "Hang on," they say. "This ain't no merchant ship," and he's off rowing as fast as he can back to port. Drake's got a boat out after them. That is the new ship that had just sailed in. That's what he wants. English will get on board and wahoo, we've got another ship again, full of stuff. Drake will plunder the ship and he's off again looking for that treasure ship. Off he goes, knocking over other ships and raiding ports. He'll find that he's catching up. One of the ships he's captured along the way did have some nice gold to take. His sailors were looking this thing over and thinking about taking the ship as well. The crew will be ordered to get their gear. You guys are going ashore. The captain will say to Drake, "Hey, mate, look, this ship's the only thing I own. What'll I do?" Drake said, "Oh, look, mate, don't worry. We might not take her, and if we do, I'll pay you with a nice bit of that gold." All good for the captain, though. The English are back off to the Golden Hind. But hang on, they're back, and in a nasty mood, saying, your clerk withheld some treasure from us. Now, what had happened was that Spanish ship had had some black guys, and Drake, by now, would just free black guys and offer them some jobs on his ship if they wanted to. It was these black guys who said there was more gold back on the Spanish ship. There was no more gold on that ship, but the ship's clerk will be hung until he blacks out, then revived. Then he'll get a dunking, but then he'll be set free. Now, that's torture, plain and simple, so we do have to give Francis Drake some demerit points for that. 1st of March 1579, and there's that treasure ship. Who says it's the treasure ship? There's a ship following us. Nothing to worry about, only Spanish ships in the Pacific. Drake will tow some pots behind to slow him down while still showing his full sails. It allows us to just sneak up. 9 hours later and we've caught up to a ship that doesn't have its full sails up. As we get right up close, the Spaniards will say, bugger me upside down, it's the fucking Poms. Strike sail. Oi, yell the English, none of that, mate, or we'll send you to have a squeeze at the bottom of the ocean. It's a Spanish ship, but one that didn't need much in the way of guns. There's no enemies around. The Spaniards will have a crack at running away, so Drake will fire some shot to bring down their mizzenmast while our sailors are firing arquebuses at them. In we go to get the captain and take him aboard the Golden Hind, where Drake will give him a nice friendly hug. Have patience. Such is the custom of war. And he'll be needing that patience as both ships are to be taken further out to sea to undertake the long, slow moving of the treasure. 14 chests of silver, 80 pounds of gold, and 26 tons of silver bars. Are you thinking absolute fucking jackpot? Correct. It's valued at around 126,000 English pounds, or about half of Betty's annual income. Better, of course. That's just the amount declared by the Spaniards, with their saying there was way more unregistered silver on board. That is, stuff that private guys are trying to sneak around without the government knowing. The bullion was transferred to the Golden Hind, then, as his way, Drake set his prisoners free, with every man on that ship getting a nice present. Drake also gave the captain a safe conduct letter in case his two missing ships happened along. He's got the gold, but he'll now need a safe harbour, and the Spanish ships will certainly be looking for him. The Golden Hind needed its keel cleaned, and we need fresh water and food. Still heading north past Panama, he'll find Nicaragua, and there's a ship. Now Drake just can't help himself, so he'll take it. This one had just returned from the Philippines. It may be that you already know who the Philippines are named for. Yeah, those people will always remember our Spanish Phil. Drake will be very interested in their pilot and offer him plenty of cash. The guy won't cooperate. While that's all happening, another ship sails in, and again, Drake just can't help himself. 4 chests of Chinese porcelain and silk, some nice food and water, and a more cooperative pilot. Drake will again let all prisoners go with a nice present. These guys are shocked after all the stories going around about the barbaric Frenchy privateers who just kill everybody. Further north for Drake to Mexico, 13th to the 16th of April 1579, Guatulco. And do you need me to say he captured the port? He captured the port. There you go. I've said it. Food, water and precious stuff all taken. While these men are ransacking the town, Drake will entertain the dignitaries to lunch and give them an inspection of his ship. Drake will boast he'll be off to Acapulco to burn the town. That's just a diversion to get Spanish ships to all head there. But really, he's thinking about Devon. Should he keep going north to look for the Northwest Passage, or go back south and around the tip of America? Or perhaps ditch the Golden Hind and go overland across Panama? Maybe he should just follow Magellan and try for the round-the-world thing. The Spanish have reinforced the West Indies in case he goes across Panama, and they've got ships protecting the Magellan Strait in case he goes there. They don't think he's going to try sailing across the Pacific or the Northwest Passage. At this time, he's back to 2 ships, about 60 humans, and a big old swag of treasure. Just got to get all this back to England. Okay, sailing back south will be out after those severe storms which lost him two ships. Besides, he's pretty sure the Spaniards will be out and about that way. Going around is pretty scary with nobody on board who's actually been that way. The Northwest Passage looks like the best option, and Drake also sees this as the fastest way home. Off he goes north, and we don't really know how far he got, but it seems pretty clear he got pretty close to the Canadian border, where it got rather chilly. So far as our primitive maps were concerned, he should have found the Northwest Passage by now. Nothing else for it, he's going to have to brave the Pacific Ocean. He'll head back and stop in what is now San Francisco to prepare his ships.
Down by the window, just looking out at the rain. Just looking out at the rain. Some came along, honey grabbed a hold of me, and it fell like a ball and chain.
Yeah, just a little bit early for the Monterey Pop Festival. That won't happen until 1967. Now, San Francisco is a magnificent harbour, beautiful place. Tons of hunting at the old things goes on in Drake's Bay, and they found tons of stuff. Mainly from the San Augustine, which went down in 1595, but no positive evidence of Francis Drake. Until 1887, when a schooner will pull up an anchor inscribed Francis Drake. Don't be fooled, that's just some guys looking to make a quick buck. It's not real. Until 1937, when a guy will phone Professor Herbert Bolton at the Uni of California to say he's found a metal plate with the date 17th of June 1579, claiming the new land Albion for our Betty and signed Francis Drake. Instant excitement, my dear listener, because we know Drake did in fact put up a metal plate somewhere. This thing is solid brass, a bit bigger than your hand, with a hole in the bottom right-hand corner, just big enough to put an English sixpence in. That plate will be sold for 3,500 American buckaroos in 1938. Big pile of cash. 1977, and we have the science to take a better squeeze at that plate, and of course it is a fake. Drake will meet the locals, and of course he's rather cautious by now, but this mob are friendly. They like Drake, who of course is handing out presents. On about the third meeting, the chief comes in. Drake describes him as the king. There will be a long speech, which the English of course can't understand, but Drake reckons the locals think the English are gods and want to hand over North America to him. He tells us that the women scratched their faces until they bled, which he knew meant they thought he was a god, but we'll later find out it meant the locals thought the English were ghosts.
Of life, the tomahawk and the bow and knife, took away our native tongue, and taught their English to our young. We made by hands.
Paul Revere Dick there. He dropped the Dick and just became Paul Revere and the Raiders to knock out Indian Reservation in the early 70s. Drake, so far as we know, didn't meet any Cherokee. Their name isn't Cherokee anyway. Cherokee is a language, and we think they're probably talking about Iroquois. Drake met the Miwok people in California. Believe it or believe it, we've already got humanitarians in Europe saying this taking over land from indigenous people is a very bad idea. Yeah, say the rich, but think of the money. And hey, these people are only pagans and savages who don't even know how to farm. Drake obviously, though, had the idea that these people possessed America with his view that they were trying to give it to him. They did give him some sort of headwear and a stick which he called a crown and scepter. Eventually, he'll be off with the locals all boo-hoo-hooing when he goes. Yeah, they might not boo-hoo-hoo when the English come back. No, what am I saying? They definitely will boo-hoo-hoo when the English come back, but in a different sort of way. Time to brave the Pacific, but at least he's got those stolen maps, so he's got an idea of how far he needs to go to find land again. We know in the 21st century that even that map he's got is off, and it'll be further than Drake thinks. Magellan had done it in worse conditions, in that Drake is fully provisioned and his ship just repaired. He's heading southwest with the trade winds, looking to stay north of the tricky current at the equator. 68 days later, he will be the first European to hit Palau, which is a small island off the coast of the Philippines. In come a heap of canoes, with the English thinking trade and the locals thinking just grab whatever you can and nick off. Before you know it, we're throwing things at each other. Drake will fire a warning shot, but when that doesn't work, it's out with a cannon smashing up a number of canoes. Now, Drake will not be proud of this action. Then it's on to the Philippines, turn south, and you hit the Maluku Islands. It's Indonesia, the Spice Girl Islands that the English have been wanting to find. That's the good news, with the bad news that it's Portuguese and Spanish territory. Well, Portuguese right now, because the Spanish had given over their whatever rights or whatever papal bullshit to the Portuguese. Point is, Portugal have had about 50 years to fortify the place, and they won't like an Englishman turning up. Now we can see how useless his maps are with all those Indonesian islands. Drake will pick up a fisherman here and there to help guide him through the islands. They'll let him know that the locals totally hate the Portuguese. The Sultan of Ternate, Babu, had found his dad dead thanks to the Portuguese. And there's nothing he'd like more than a hand to boot the fucking Portuguese out. Drake will get an invite to have a barbecue with Babu. It will be roll out the 16th century Indonesian version of the red carpet. While Drake's chatting with Babu, lots of nice food will be delivered to his ship. Drake will do a deal. English warships to come in for a very nice trade deal. As a sign of good faith, Drake will take on 6 tons of cloves. Very expensive stuff in Europe because Portugal had a monopoly on it. Yeah, Babu and his son, after him, will write frequently to England saying, "Where are those warships?" While Portugal slowly crushes all resistance. Drake knows that his next challenge will be the Indian Ocean, so he's off looking for another safe spot to carry out maintenance, and he'll find a nice deserted island. It's got timber and water, so great. 12th of December 1579, he'll be off again, leaving 3 black humans to populate that island. A guy, a gal, and a baby she'd had on the way. He left them some food and fire-making equipment, along with seeds to grow food. Now, we're not sure what this is about, whether he's just trying to save his own food supplies and dumping them, or if they asked to be left. But at least they were no longer Spanish slaves, and he gave them some gear to get going. Tricky bit for him now, sailing through the Celebes Sea with its submerged reefs. Not only that, it's another maze of islands, and we've got no maps for this. It looks a bit like we're through, so it's hoist sails and we're off. Until 8 p.m, 9th of January, when we come to a sudden halt after hitting a reef. Oh, we're all doomed, my dear listeners. That's what the sailors are calling out. We're over the shock of a sudden stop, and the ship will heel over. In comes a strong wind to push the ship back upright, but that'll also push us further into the reef. Francis Drake will kick off with a communal prayer, then get the pumps going to reduce the water in the hold. And hey, we can examine the damage. It's not that bad. Drake will be off in a boat with an anchor. If he can fix the anchor, then the guys on the ships should be able to use that to pull the ship off the reef. Good plan, except his stepped line of 300 fathoms will fail to find the bottom. More praying then, and toss stuff overboard to see if the ship will float. It won't. Then, wahoo, the wind will change direction and just push them off. Drake is elated and will have his parson chained up and excommunicated. We don't have an explanation for this, but it certainly may be that it seems any time anything went wrong during this whole voyage, the parson would say, "It's God's revenge on Drake for being naughty." Perhaps Drake was a bit over that. After repairs, he'll sail to Java, heading south to avoid Portuguese, and become the first European to work out that Java's an island. Portuguese thought it was part of Terra Australis. Drake can stock up again, ready for the big push across the Indian Ocean. Only 2 months and we spot South Africa. And just as well, we're desperate for water. Drake, though, will sail all the way round and north to Sierra Leone, familiar territory, before stopping off for water. Now, Francis Drake knows his way home from here. He's been to Sierra Leone before when he was a young'un. Problem now is, what sort of reception will he get in England? He's taken a ton of treasure from Spanish Field, and by now England might be Catholic again, with Mary Queen of Scots on the big chair. 26th of September 1580, in England, and in comes a ship. And as they pass some fishermen, they'll ask an odd question. Is the Queen still alive? Yeah, medieval babes are still playing, they say. The mini-series about Betty isn't finished yet. That missing ship, which had sailed back through the Magellan Strait, has sailed in 15 months earlier, so the English had his story. The Portuguese ambassador has also been in to give Betty an earful about Drake's plundering of their stuff. Hey, we've got the world's oldest continual treaty, Betty, so that's not nice. Our returning captain, though, will have a very rare attack of conscience. Most people could ditch that for money, but our captain will sadly say, "Yeah, I had a hand in knocking over Portuguese ships, and I went along with that execution of Doughty, and worse, look, it was me. I deserted the commander. It was me, and I've been a bad, bad boy." Our captain will be told, "Yeah, you are a bad, bad boy. Now give the Portuguese back their toys and accompany these gentlemen to the slammer." "Hang on," he says. "I've just remembered, nice and clear, like, it was all Francis Drake. He's the villain of the story." Drake, though, will actually intercede for him and say, "Hey, look, the slammer for this guy's a bit much." Worse, a year ago, Spanish Phil got a text saying, "Fucking English sailing around the Pacific, nicking stuff." Fortunately, Phil was rather busy at the time, and while Francis had scored a fortune for an ordinary guy, it's a drop in the bucket for Phil. What he is worried about more than Francis Drake is the Francis Drake copycats that he's already seen in the West Indies. He will order the Magellan Straits fortified and send a message to the Portuguese. "Keep an eye out round the Spice Girl Islands for Francis Drake and send him to sleep with the fishes." Lastly, it'll be a claim sent to Betty for Spanish booty. A few weeks later and the news will hit England. Spanish ambassador, another Mendoza, will write, "The adventurers who provided money and ships for the voyage are beside themselves for joy, and I am told there are some of the councillors among them. The people here are talking of nothing else but going out to plunder in a similar way." But for the English now, it's a matter of waiting to see if Drake can get home, and that will be pretty much a year. As for Phil's claim, Drake had some pretty big swinging dick investors in this thing, and they're thinking jackpot, not, "Oh, should we give Phil back his cash?" Drake might have got a whole heap of Spanish gold and silver, but it's small potatoes on the international scene, so ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, meet Alexander Farnese, who'd be, let's see, great-grandson of Alessandro Farnese, Pope Paul III, and inventor of the Dutch Counter-Reformation. He's been dead for years, who cares? It's Alexander, Duke of Parma, we care about, Alexander Farnese. His mum was Margaret, a byblow of Super Sausage Chuck. Have we had byblow before? It's a bastard. But she's done okay marrying Ottavio Farnese. She doesn't like him. I did want to do a story ages ago and never did. Let's have the shorthand version. Hang on a tick. Let's just go over the Farnese thing. Alessandro, Pope Paul III, had an illegitimate son, Piero, who had actually been involved in that sack of Rome. Alessandro will get Piero nicely married to an Orsino noble girlie. Pope Paul will make him Duke of Parma, where they do a nice chicken dish. Super Sausage Chuck said, fuck that, I own Parma. Piero can then be assassinated. But he knocked out Ottavio Farnese, who will just marry Super Sausage's bastard kitty Margaret to get the Duke of Parma gig right back. Margaret's mum was a saucy servant wench who Chuck rather admired. Through Chuck, though, her great auntie Margaret had run Austria, as had her auntie Mary of Austria. Running stuff well runs in the girly side of the family. Who'd have thought that? She was betrothed to various guys from age 5, but none of those deals came true. Well, actually, it did come through with Alessandro de' Medici, Duke of Florence, but he was the one with the dark skin, which we all thought was a bit dodgy, so his distant cousin Lorenzo de' Medici will pop a dagger in and out, while Alessandro Medici bit a bit of Lorenzo's finger right off. A year later, and she's married to Ottavio. She's 16 and he's 14, and she had said, not marrying this turd. Don't panic, Margaret, the feeling is mutual, so the two will meet up for the occasional banging to get an heir, but Margaret was left free mainly to study. 1555 and 33-year-old Margaret is off to the Netherlands to be governor. Margaret will give it a very good go, but that would be rather difficult for her with those dear, sweet, kind-loving and gentle brothers of St. Dominic operating around the place, pointing out to Protestants where they've gone wrong. Phil had also given a limited authority, and fair enough, she's a girlie, so she had to listen to Cardinal Grenville. And if you're guessing that the Lowlanders think that Cardinal Grenville is a total dick, well spotted. Margaret will promise to stop the religious repression. Great, say the Protestants, who will be straight into the shit fuckery by destroying religious images. Margaret will get hard man support to stop the riot, but Phil will send in hard man Duke of Alva, with Margaret saying, hey, Phil, this guy will just make things worse. Phil won't listen, and the 80-year war will kick off. Margaret will check over Alva's authority levels, see that they're higher than her own, and resign. Margaret will be off to semi-retirement as governor of Abruzzo. She'll die age 63, and I forgot what the main point was. No, I haven't. It's because it's about the Duke of Alva has now buggered off, finally, and Margaret's lad, Alexander Farnese, is running the show in the Lowlands and getting things nicely under control. But all that had kept Spanish Phil rather busy. Plus, King of Portugal, Sebastian, had died 1578. He was 24 and had no kiddies. Sebastian had been off to Morocco for a dust-up, which resulted in his death and pretty much the entire Portuguese nobility. 15,000 Portuguese prisoners of war will now experience slavery firsthand. With the king and most of the nobility gone, we'd scratched our head and came up with Sebastian's uncle, Cardinal Henry, fifth son of Manuel I of Portugal. So in goes 66-year-old Henry the Chaste to sit on the big chair for 2 years and die, also without kiddies. We'd been down the bottom of the barrel to pick Henry the Chaste, so we're now totally out of Portuguese options. Spanish Phil will say, hang on a tick, I'm dead Henry the Chaste's cousin, so it should be me. Portuguese said, fuck off. Phil said, have a squeeze at my hard men entering your country. So the Portuguese said, welcome King Phil of Spain and Portugal, mate. Well, I've really shorthanded that, but yeah, he's now the King of Portugal as well. That, of course, was 1580, so for Spanish Phil, the Francis Drake thing wasn't the biggest chore on his list of things to do. Phil's got Spain, Portugal, the Lowlands, and he now dominates the African coast, the Indian Ocean, the East Indies, and South America. This is a big old empire. Taking stock then, this is rivaling the empire of Genghis Khan. The Mongol Empire was the largest contiguous empire, but Phil's dick is now bigger than Genghis's dick. Phil's income is probably more than the rest of Europe combined. His navy is 6 times the size of England's. Drake is just a tick, and Betty doesn't want to upset Phil. She is doing the right thing, though. She's always encouraging trade with Spain and, in theory, staying neutral in the lowlands and being neutral with the Frenchies. Neither Phil or Betty would be wanting war, but we did have those Spaniards land in Ireland in 1579 to get another Irish rebellion going. Still, those guys were under orders from the Pope and not Phil. He's got the plausible deniability for a change. In go our brave English lads to Ireland and just slaughter the opposition. Spanish Phil will be telling Betty, nothing to do with me, it's all the Pope's doing. Betty will call bullshit on Phil. Those were Spanish troops, mate. So it's this tit-for-tat going on between Betty and Phil when Francis Drake sailed on in. To the plague. Did I mention that? Yeah, no cheering mob at the dock. Just some guy saying, hey, buddy, you might want to stay on your ship for a bit. Not good here. Francis certainly will be writing, though, particularly to his financial backers. Mainly Francis Walsingham and Robert Dudley saying, yeah, I might need a bit of help here. That plague delay, though, will get the news out to the common smelly types, and it's all we want to talk about. How mighty he is, and he's even given Spanish Phil a bit of a kicking. We all think he's great. Betty will summon the council. Not many guys around, with plague, of course, so there'll only be five, and one of these, Earl of Lincoln, Lord Admiral, is a Drake financial backer. Their advice to Betty is that we might have to hand that gold and stuff back to Phil, but step one is we need to secure it in the Tower of London. Drake's financial backers will now swing into action. Walsingham, Dudley and Hatton, Betty's other toy boy, and they'll all refuse to sign off on the moving of the treasure to the Tower. They don't want to lose their share. Privy Council is split and it's a stalemate. Drake, though, will receive a nice invitation to Arvo Tea from Betty, and please bring some samples of what you picked up. Drake gets this message. Bring me nice stuff that is very valuable, is what it is. No idea what went down, but that meeting will last 6 hours, where Drake can show her a map that says Elizabeth Islands and Nova Albion, and tells tales of swashbuckling adventures. And you won't believe it, Betty, but I've got a ridgy-didge, fair-dinky-dye trade agreement with the Spice Girl Islands. Betty will be rather pleased and say, hey, look, Francis, even if we do have to return some stuff to Phil, I'll make sure you won't miss out, mate. Very well done from your queen to you. Off you go and register that treasure and send it to the Tower where it'll be very safe. No, hang on. I'll send a letter with you to Edmund Tremayne, your Member of Parliament, and Clerk to the Privy Council to tell him to give you a hand. And what did that letter say, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls? It said, hey, Ed, Francis Drake will be sneaking £10,000 worth of stuff off the Golden Hind to his house before you start registering what he has. Be a good boy and slip off to the pub while he's doing that. And never ever mention my name on this. How will Francis deal with this? Well, that £10,000 will be off his ship in no time flat. He'll slip a further £14,000 off for his sailors, then who knows what else he managed to hide or sneak out. After all that, then, we have a nice record of what was registered and sent to London. This will be way short of what Francis had nicked. Spanish ambassador will claim Betty snuck out £100,000 for herself. While the sorting out and registering of the treasure was going on, the council were arguing over whether or not it should be sent back to Phil. Spanish Ambassador Mendoza found he couldn't get anyone at all to see him. Worse for Mendoza, there's a representative of the Merchants of Seville in London giving him a hard time about why aren't you getting in there and getting our stuff back. And just remember, mate, it ain't all Phil's, some of that's ours. Some of our councillors are now saying it should go back to Phil if he can reasonably account for his soldiers being in Ireland. Walsingham and Dudley will be saying, fuck that. If we're going to donate it somewhere, then it should be off to the Huguenots and Flemish. And hey, there's no treaty between England and Spain that says a private Englishman can't go sailing around the world. Betty will write to Mendoza saying, gossip's out that you're complaining about Francis Drake, but I've got no idea why. I've investigated his activities and find he's done nothing at all to upset Spain. But look, if I find out anything different, you can be sure that justice will be done. Love, Betty. Mendoza will now be a dickhead of an ambassador, really, or just a standard ambassador, I suppose. He'll say that Drake cut the hands off Spanish prisoners. Great for Betty, because the entire crew will now be interviewed and say what a great guy Francis was to his captors. And in case you forgot, my dear listener, he's got a couple of Spanish pilot captives too, and these guys will say, yeah, Francis is a real humanitarian. Just gives all his captives presents and then lets them go. We can tell Mendoza to stick his allegation of atrocities committed to prisoners where the sun don't shine. We still then have the allegation of theft, and that's tricky. Believe it or believe it, not all the stuff Francis nicked was registered with the Spanish. Those Spanish types in the Americas had their own graft going on. Mendoza knew that had been going on, so his claim for unregistered treasure will be going into the nice, messy, too-hard basket. Drake, meantime, can say none of what I nicked was unregistered, mate. And Mendoza can't answer that. It's unregistered. Nobody knows about it. Further, he can now claim that the Spanish themselves nicked stuff that he hadn't even seen and were blaming it on him. This is going well for Francis. And so it goes on with Mendoza getting hot and sweaty about a meeting with Betty and Betty saying, no, I don't want to meet you. I'm still thinking about this Irish stuff. Mendoza will start talking up war, and the Spanish merchants are talking up economic sanctions. Cecil's in her ear saying, give Phil his stuff back. Betty, though, is our queen of the people, and all everyone is talking about is the marvellous Francis Drake. And so for Betty, it will be a tit-for-tat situation. Drake in the Pacific being the tat for Spanish soldiers in Ireland being all tits. Drake is a great Protestant champion who has discovered the unknown. And I like all that cash being in England, she says. The amount that ended up in the tower was £264,000. £29,000 will go to the Dutch Protestants. The new Levant Trading Company will score £42,000, as will Alencon, because he's going to go and fight the bloody Spanish fill in the lowlands again. Betty's step for the Irish campaign will be repaid to keep up our good credit rating. New Year's Day, 1581, and Francis Drake is totally secure. He's achieved way more than those guys in court have, the ones that just flatter Betty. His name has spread throughout Europe. He's feared by the Spaniards and a wonder to anyone else. New Year's Day, of course, is gift-giving day. Mendoza will write, Drake is squandering more money than any man in England, and proportionately, all those who came with him are doing the same. He gave to the Queen the crown which I have described in a former letter as having been made here. She wore it on New Year's Day. It has in it 5 emeralds, 3 of them almost as long as a little finger, while the 2 round ones are valued at 20,000 crowns, coming as they do from Peru. He has also given the Queen a diamond cross as a New Year's gift, as is the custom here, of the value 5,000 crowns. He offered to Cecil 10 bars of fine gold worth 300 crowns each, which, however, he refused, saying he did not know how his conscience would allow him to accept a present from Drake, who had stolen all he had. He gave Sussex 800 crowns in salvers and vases, but these also were refused in the same way. The Chancellor got 800 crowns worth of silver plate, and all the councillors and secretaries had a share in similar form, Leicester getting most of all. That's Dudley. The Queen shows extraordinary favour to Drake and never fails to speak to him when she goes out in public, conversing with him for a long time. She says she will knight him on the day she goes to see his ship. She's ordered the ship itself to be brought ashore and placed in her arsenal near Greenwich as a curiosity. And so we'll leave Francis to be the darling of the country, with, of course, a number of courtiers perhaps not liking him so much. Just a little bit of Andrei Vinogradov with a bit of hurdy-gurdy music to get us into some historical fiction. And it's a movie called Edge of the World or Raja. Seems like they couldn't quite make up their mind what they wanted to call it, so you might find it under one of those two names. This is about a guy, Sir James Brooke, who was knocking around in the 19th century. This is the age of the British Empire, so this guy was born in India as a kiddie in that sort of British East India Company kind of takeover of the place. He turned into an army type, got wounded, and then resigned his commission. He bought a ship and sailed out to Malaysia, where he helped crush a rebellion and became the governor of Sarawak. Not for the British, this was for the locals. He was then trying to get into pirates who were operating the place, and in the melee there, he restored the Sultan of Brunei to his throne, and the Sultan thanked him by making Raja of Sarawak, which he ruled until he died. So the movie is about those events in Sarawak. We've got Jonathan Rhys-Meyers in the title role. Of course, he was Henry in The Tudors. And I've read some bits and pieces along the way where I think he lives a bit hard for Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, and he might be showing it. This movie didn't totally convince me, I have to say. I think it might have been a little bit all over the shop. Could have benefited from a bit better script writing or something. I don't know. There was something about it. I'm just thinking, yeah, you know, this is okay. So there you go. If you want to fill in some time and you'd like to see what was going on in that part of the world in the 19th century, have a crack at it. Raja or Edge of the World. Yeah, one of the two. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And how about a bit of Chris Isaak, Baby Did a Bad Thing. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Bad thing.